I'll continue. So, the first step, now that we touched upon all the ways to get or at least obtain the power signal, we have to perform the actual acquisition. My colleague back in Holland who made this part of the slides was feeling a little bit funny. So finding the right acquisition parameters, so that means the timing and the ranges of the scope and sampling rate. So we use this highly adaptive expert system that comes built in with feedback and control mechanisms. Or in other words, trial and error. As with, you know, also the larger steps of doing sidechain analysis is really about just tuning and making sure you get something nice on your screen. A little bit of background on scopes and sampling, because we see that a lot of people just get into this. They need to get a little bit of background on what it means to actually digitize the signal, because we're talking about analog signals that we need to bring into the computer in a digital form. And it still looks like a nice analog waveform, but that's not what it is internally. So let's say that this is the signal that we're going to try to sample using a scope. I don't know if you just saw that, but if you sample exactly at the peaks and the bottoms of that, that's actually a signal that in the computer will look like. Do you guys see the gray dots? Or those gray dots? It'll look like this. So you have a high voltage, low voltage, high voltage, low voltage. And that's a representation of that original analog signal in the computer. So you can actually completely reconstruct it if you know it's a sine wave. You just draw that through the point and you're good, right? Now, the tricky thing comes in when, let's say you have that, the original signal again, but we actually sample too slow. So there's a clock that is taking samples of this signal, but let's say that the clock is slower than this sine wave itself. So we get the first top there on the left, but we miss the second dip, so we're sampling a little bit later, and we're missing that top, and you actually get this really weird signal that looks like this. So once you start interpolating those points again, you're actually getting a sine wave that's of a lower frequency than the original one you intended to capture. So this for side channel, this can be an issue. So if your information is in between one of those tips somewhere, you may have missed it. Or maybe it's in a very high frequency signal, which you're not representing in the correct way. So if you're undersampling, it can be an issue. So what we usually recommend, the theoretical limit is that you need two samples per sine wave, right? You need the top and the bottom, and then you can interpolate. But if you're off by a certain phase, it can get messy. So we usually say, if you know that your target is running at 100 megahertz, sample at least at 200, but if you can, at like 500 megahertz. So you get a nice representation of what that signal looks like. And what we can always do later, once we have it in the computer, we can start processing it down again. Another thing that we see and that we internally usually joke as going back into the 8-bit Mario world. You guys are familiar with Nintendo, right? The 8-bit. So at the bottom right, you see a Mario level, basically where you have all these blocks that you have to jump up and down on. It was fun in the 80s to play these games, but when you see this on your scope, you actually have a problem. Because you're not representing this wave very nicely. So the problem you have is something that's called quantization noise. Because just as we were digitizing in time before, we also need to digitize in the voltage levels. Because a computer cannot represent an arbitrary precision number, so it has to be a fixed number. So that's where these levels come from. But if you have a signal and you represent it with too few bits, you get these really weird quantization errors. Now, if you're talking about systems where we are leaking data values, we may be talking about nanovolt differences, really tiny, tiny differences, which is where the actual leakage is. So if we start capturing it like that, we lose most of that information. Interestingly, it's still, if you do it statistically, you can still pull it out, but you're losing a lot of information there. And that's because that little tiny bit of voltage can actually push you up into the next quantization level, if you're lucky enough. Anyway, that's statistics. But what we do is we actually make sure that the oscilloscope has a certain range. So you can say, hey, I want to capture all the signals from minus 2 to plus 2 volts. And that's the range it subdivides into all these levels. You got to make sure that your oscilloscope range really fits your signal well. So if your signal is 2 volts and you set your range to 10 volts, then you get the bottom right problem there. If it's 2 volts and you set it to 2 volts, you get a nice signal. If the signal is 2 volts and you set your oscilloscope to 1 volt, you get a different problem, which is clipping. So if it cannot represent a number over 1 volt, it'll actually just say 1 volt. So you don't get a nice sine wave, but you basically cut off all the tops of these sine waves. So even getting the, you know, that part right, this is not hard, but you just need to be aware of the issues. Then a little bit on how do you obtain these quality measures? Measurements. Embedded devices are usually complex, at least. Maybe to give you an idea, so in our lab we test everything from simple microcontrollers, one, you know, smart cards, one CPU, one crypto accelerator, that's it, all the way up to set-top boxes, like what you have at home to decode your TV channels, that has multiple general-purpose CPUs, decoders, decryption engines, a whole bunch of stuff, and you're only interested in that one key that sits in there somewhere. So all these other processes are noise. So, yeah, that's something with EM. Sometimes you can move your probe to a part where you have more of the crypto leakage rather than the noise. But it's something you have to deal with. What you can see is that you have, on these larger SoCs, you have different power domains. So they actually get different voltages to the chip. This can actually be an advantage from an attacker point of view. Because if, I haven't seen this yet, but I'm waiting for the day when somebody decides to put the crypto core on their own power plate. So that would give me just the perfect signal to tap on the outside. Because only if that only that thing gets powered by it, that's where I want to do my measurements. But usually crypto cores are on the same power planes as the main cores, which is usually the lower voltage ones. Same thing about you have multiple clock domains, so there will be multiple operating frequencies on the chip. Again, that's something you can use as well. So if you, for instance, find out through some means that the crypto core is running at 125 megahertz, whereas the main core is running at a gigahertz, you can actually do some frequency filtering and just throw out the 1 gigahertz signals and try to focus on the 125 only. High clock speeds is also a challenge in the sense that you need to buy a bigger oscilloscope, and bigger oscilloscopes are more expensive. But that allows you to keep up with higher clock speeds. So what I have here, this scope is, I believe it's $2,500 or something. So this is really low end, which works for my nice and slow target device there. Because I think the clock on that thing is like 80 megahertz. This scope goes up to 250 megahertz, so plenty of bandwidth. But in the lab, we have like 10 gigahertz scopes for the larger SoCs, where you're talking about gigahertz of clock speeds. I talked about finding the power domain. When we're in a lab setting, so when we're actually testing leakage of certain cores, we usually have a lot of control over the SoC as well. So what you would typically do is you shut off all the subsystems you don't really need. So you make sure that only the crypto is, or at least the fewest possible subsystems, including the crypto, is running. Another thing that you'll often see is that any chip is surrounded by all these nice little square blocks. I don't know if you ever opened up a device and looked at it, but these are called decoupling capacitors. And what they actually do is they try to filter out environmental noise. So when you look at the power supplies that are coming out of the outlets here, they're actually not a nice 110 volt sine wave. There's a lot of noise on that. If that noise goes all the way to your chip, it might actually cause faults, which is the topic of this afternoon, but it may actually cause faults on the chip. So to prevent that, they put a lot of these decoupling capacitors around the chip to kind of flatten out all the weird noisy signals that you get just from the mains. In order to do power analysis, though, it also filters the power consumption of the actual device. So we don't want that. So what we usually do before we put something in on the oscilloscope is we remove as many decoupling capacitors from the board as we can until the chip stops working, and we put the last one back in, and then it works good enough for us, and we can get at least a better signal out of it without having these filters in between. I talked about sampling rates. So here you actually have a picture of the backside of this little board that we have. So you see the red circles there. That's where we used to have decoupling capacitors. So this thing actually had quite a few of them, about 20 or so. And we could remove them all, and it was still running quite well. So it wasn't too sensitive to external glitches on the power line. On the other side, that's where the main chip is. So we just desoldered them, and the boards were still running. So you can do the desoldering either based on schematics, so you know which ones are the actual decoupling capacitors. You can also just measure whether a specific capacitor has a ground connection or not, which is an indication that it is a decoupling capacitor. So this is actually more or less the setup that I have here. I'm going into a little bit more detail here. So we have the current probe that's actually hooked up into the oscilloscope. Now, you need to tell an oscilloscope to get ready for a measurement. So that's called the arm command. So you actually then send an arm to your oscilloscope, which means it'll start waiting for the trigger to come in. The next thing we do is we send the encryption command to the target, and the target will take that, decode it, send it over a bus to the crypto engine, kick off. There's lots of stuff usually happening in the device as well before the actual crypto engine starts. We either have a trigger that's generated by the device itself, or we can also construct the trigger ourselves if we don't have that capability of programming the device. For now, just assume we have this trigger. So as soon as the command goes to the crypto core, ideally the crypto core, but usually the main core will pull up the hardware trigger, and that's when we start our actual measurement. So you use this to make sure that, you know, this is a real-time system, basically. So as soon as the crypto happens, your scope needs to be ready and go. So that's why these are all hardware signals and why the target is starting the oscilloscope instead of the PC starting the oscilloscope. You can do that, and we've done that in the past as well, where we had no trigger, weren't able to make a trigger. We're like, okay, we give up, we're just not going to synchronize it properly. And what you see is because the PC is a system where you can't really depend on timing at all, and it's actually connected to the oscilloscope through an Ethernet cable, so there's no time constant things happening there either. So you'll see that the crypto, you know, you have to take a very long acquisition, and you'll see it jumping in your window. If you're lucky, it's in your window. And then what you have to do is you have to basically detect the crypto using signal processing and shift it again. It gets complicated. Any problem can be solved, but if you're doing this in a lab setting, we always do a trigger because it just gets too expensive otherwise. So after the trigger happened, the crypto ran on the embedded system, it sends back the ciphertext, and the PC captures all that. And then the PC also pulls the acquisition data from the scope. And then we get these nice traces. The only difference here really is, maybe didn't make that entirely clear. This is with the current probe, so that's where we put it in line of the power supply. This picture is with an EM probe. The rest of the flow is exactly the same. So you're still arm, command, trigger acquisition, and you get an EM trace instead of a power trace. Okay. So let's go into the acquisition just a little bit more on the board itself. Do a quick time check. I'm supposed to be here at 10:15. 4 minutes late. I'll talk fast. Let me just show you, instead of the perfect flow that I had this morning, the things that can go wrong. Because you've already seen what happens if you do it the right way. Let's say I don't have a trigger. So this is actually my trigger signal. I have now disconnected it. So the scope actually doesn't know when the crypto is happening. So it'll time out and then actually take some measurement, because it wants to do something, it's a scope. The thing about this is, this actually looks like an interesting signal to me. I measure noise, by the way, because this is completely after the crypto. So you really always have to be careful about, and this is what I tell any of my new colleagues when I'm training them, is like, double checking is not enough. Like, every step you do in this chain, you need to triple, quadruple check it, because it's too easy to get to take a wrong step somewhere and then just completely lose your path. So this is what can happen if you miss the trigger. I can actually reconnect this again so you can see that. There's our crypto again. So it's basically now again aligned with the crypto engine, instead of that it's measuring somewhere before or after it. Show you some of the other issues that you may run into. So remember I was talking about that the range, so you need to match that to your signal. So if I set it really large, my signal is actually 2 volts plus and minus, and I've set the scope to go to 20 volts, it should start looking like Super Mario World. So you can really see that you now have these giant steps. So this is something that if you know about this, you can visually clue in on immediately and fix it. And it's an easy fix, because on the scale here, I can actually read what the range of the signal is. So the next time I take a trace, I'm just going to set it. You can see it just going over 1 volt. So to be on the safe side, you go to the next one up, which is 2 volts. Because otherwise you get the clipping, which I can also show. So if I, instead of 20 volts, take 500 millivolts, you see at the top here, it's flat and cut off. I'm going to zoom in further. I can even see here that these peaks are basically just flatlining at the top there. Just for your information, we're here really at the clock cycle level, so you can zoom out, and then at some point you get to the process level. And it's a needle in a haystack, but that's why we have statistics. What else can I tell you about acquisition? Yeah, actually, one of the key things to keep in mind is that when you're doing certification, usually what you're not so interested in is how many traces does it take for me to get the key out. Because traces, I mean, what does it really mean? If I put a different probe there, it's going to be a different number of traces. If I take a different scope, it's going to be a different number of traces. It just depends on so many factors. So in the certification world, what people usually use is the time and the equipment and the expertise that's needed to get to key leakage. So actually, optimizing your acquisition is a very fundamental part of that. Because if you can acquire twice the number of traces per second as with a slower setting, you actually have a lot more data to pull keys from. So within a week, all of a sudden, I've doubled the amount of information that I have. So from a certification point of view, even things like how well did you tune your acquisition are relevant factors. And it can make a big difference. If I am, set the number of samples not to 60,000, so that's the number of points it takes per trace, but I put it to, I don't know, 4 million or something like that. I'm still going to capture the AES completely. You don't see it. Oh wait, I still have my range set wrong. I did sacrifice to the demo bot this morning, so most things should go okay, but I'm sure it won't be. It won't work. So I set the number of samples that I take to 4 million instead of 60K. And I should see... Actually, this looks completely different to you, but if I zoom into the start, this should be recognizable again. So I'm still taking the same traces of the AES, but because I haven't tuned my acquisition, I'm just taking a whole bunch of samples after that as well. And I can still do the same analysis on this. Only my data size has increased by a factor, 4,000 over 60. So almost, 80 times or something like that. And so everything down the line, all my processing is going to be, my file is going to be 80 times bigger, my processing is going to be 80 times slower, if I'm lucky and I'm using linear algorithms. So even at the beginning here, optimization really makes a big difference. You can actually already see it in the acquisition itself. I'm getting about 3 per second here, whereas before it's been like 20, 30 per second or so. Get the basics right as well. Any questions on acquisition?
Are you continuing to resend the plain text from wherever it was in, or is that the first pipe there, the plain text in, ciphertext out, and then it's just doing whatever it does?
So, this, what's happening here is at this point, right at t equals 0, that's when the trigger happens. So the plain text has gone into my device, it's gone to my crypto core, the trigger's been pulled high, and then you get the same 10 rounds, and after that it sends the ciphertext back out. So somewhere in this part, just after the crypto, I'm also capturing now the ciphertext coming out. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, but it's you're not going to redo it again. Like once you get the ciphertext out,
yeah.
It's, you're just measuring normal
whatever it's doing.
EM of the chip,
yeah.
Without doing it.
Yeah. So there's just these spikes are, could very well be just waiting, in a loop waiting for the next plain text to come in. So you're just measuring whatever the chip is doing at that point. It's probably the IO routines or something like that.
And the trigger has to be programmed somehow? Explain the trigger regularly.
So what we do is when we're really focusing on leakage detection, we ask clients for either code that's running on the target, you pull a line high just before you start the crypto. So that's how you get your synchronization point.
So you have to be able to change the code.
Yeah. So if I can, I don't know if this is going to work, but let's try anyway. So if I take the trigger off, let's keep the measurement long, and I'll have it, I don't think, zero time anymore, so let's make it small. So this is what you're seeing without a trigger, and every now and then you see this little bump that's jumping, that's the crypto. So it's still there, I'm just not synchronized to it. And in this case, it's easy enough to find. Let me just abort it and zoom in so you can actually see. So that's, again, those same 10 rounds. So I don't need it, but it makes my life a lot easier. And it makes it faster again, right? Because I don't need to take this huge scope buffer. Any other questions on acquisition or otherwise? I'll move on. This is this afternoon. Now I'm going to skip a step, which is signal processing, which we'll talk about later. But I'll just talk about leakage detection. So we've got our traces, we're going to do some magic with signal processing, and then we're going to actually do this T calculation and figure out what the leakage is that's in there. The TVLA, by the way, stands for Test Vector Leakage Assessment, which is a term coined by CRI. Actually, I think in the context of FIPS a few years ago, maybe easy isn't the right word, but an early detection of leakage that doesn't require too much analyst skill to actually execute. So it basically answers the question, is there leakage, yes or no? And it uses the fundamental principle that detecting leakage, if you do it in a smart way, is actually much easier than extracting the key. And I'll show you why that is, because you can do these amplification tricks to amplify the leakage. So it was based for the proposed for 140-2, didn't materialize. We're actually using this in our lab all the time, because it's actually a nice way to detect leakage early on, maybe tweak your signal processing a bit to get the leakage stronger. A bunch of our clients don't even require the key. We used to always have to show them the key. Nowadays, they're like, okay, it leaks. I got something to fix. And the trick we're really using is we're not going to send a random plain text to encrypt, but we're going to pick them in a certain way. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to acquire two sets of traces. We'll call them group A and B. And we're going to make sure that the statistical distribution of these two groups is actually quite different. So one example is, for instance, for group A, we send completely random plain text. And for group B, we send the same plain text every time. Now, of course, when you look at the plain text, there's a large statistical difference. And the question is, does this statistical difference show up in the power traces that we're taking? Because that would indicate there's a relation between the plain text and the power consumption. Then after that, we apply this just t-test. Basically, what the t-test gives you an indication of is how far, in two distributions, how far the means of those distributions lie apart. So a high T value means that they're very different. A low T value means that they're actually the same. So it gives you a measure of distance between those two groups, and that's what we're going to use as a leakage detection. Go ahead.
So when you compare them, what type of distance measure are you using to compare? Are you Euclidean or some other?
It's a normalized, actually the formula is right there. So when I have two samples, I'll read out what it says. Basically, you take just the difference, so just minus the two means of the groups, and you normalize it by their variance. That's what it boils down to. So it's not entirely Euclidean. It's basically the mathematical minus and then normalized by the variance in that group. But it's really that top part that's the top part of the formula is the important thing, because if the
sample,
yeah,
you're comparing the samples exactly to each other,
exactly, yeah, it's not a whole lot of magic happening here. But what this basically says is if the two means are the same, this formula is going to drop to zero. So t equals zero if you have perfectly the same distribution, or at least the same mean in those two distributions. If those means start to drift further, normalized by some stuff, that's when you get to see positive values for t. Actually, this also allows for negative, but we usually look at the absolute value of t. Bunch of math, bunch of formulas, but the thing to remember is the higher the t value, the more different these two groups are that I've generated. And if the way I set it up is that I'm sending data values that are different. If those data values cause the computation to be different and therefore the leakage to be different, or that the signal that I acquire different, that means that there's a relation and therefore there's leakage. That's the line of thinking behind it. So I'm not saying anything about extracting keys. I'm basically setting up an experiment where I'm going to link the plain text that I sent to a difference in the power consumption. So a very simple thing of doing that seems reasonable is what I mentioned before. So you take one random group and one constant group. If the means of those things are the same, well, that means that there's no leakage from the device, because I can send it whatever happens, and the mean of that will be the same every time. If I'm measuring it, I can't see if something was from group A or group B. In other words, there's no leakage. One thing to keep in mind is we're not doing first a big batch of group A and then we're doing a big batch of group B. We're actually interleaving these, so we're sending at random a plain text either from A or B. And then we calculate this t-value. I mentioned earlier this morning that we use T4.5 as a cutoff value. That basically has to do with if you're going to reject the null hypothesis, you take a certain confidence. So you say, okay, with 99.999% confidence, I want to say whether the means are equal or not. Then you have to use this T value. I'm not a statistics teacher, and Wikipedia can explain this better to you than I can, but that's the idea behind it. There's actually one, when you start applying this, which is what we did, you actually run into one really interesting problem. And that is the fact that even if your crypto doesn't leak, so let's say that group A and group B, the means are exactly the same during the crypto operation, I have actually created a very large bias in the plain text. And the plain text goes into the device, gets sent through different buffers, through different buses to the crypto core, who knows what. So there's actually going to be power leakage of the plain text moving through the device. And it's going to give a large statistical difference in the power consumption. But I'm just measuring the plain text going through the device. There's no secrets there or anything, but I'm measuring a large difference. So you're going to see huge t-values at the times when plain text is moving through the device. So it's not really that interesting. And if I do this and I measure only the cryptos and not accidentally the plain text, then I'm okay. But this gives rise to false positives, especially if you don't know exactly when the crypto is happening. And you see a spike, you don't know whether it's crypto or plain text. You know, you can't really say something at that point. So there's luckily a very interesting, very clever solution for this. Is we're going to have still one random group, but we're also going to have something that we call a semi-constant group. So it's a group of plain texts which are not exactly the same, but they're from a small subset of the entire space. And they're picked very specifically. And they're picked in such a way that, given a key, which in TVLA you're allowed to know, right? We're doing leakage testing, so it's a really white box scenario. So we know the key that's in there, we just want to know the leakage. We pick an intermediate round name, around 5, 6, 4, something in the middle. And we're now going to make sure that in that middle round, we have a very small subset of things happening. For instance, or what we usually do is we say, well, we're going to set the mixed columns output of round 5 to a state that all zeros, except for maybe a few bits here and there that can be 1. So that's a very special state. It won't happen usually in practice. But the nice thing about this is it's almost a constant value. It's almost always just all 0. Whereas in the random group, it's just going to be a random intermediate state. So in a sense, we're creating the same roughly setup as in the previous slide where we had random input and constant input, except now it's only happening in that round 5. And the nice thing about AES or any cryptographic algorithm is that if you run from round 5 forwards to round 10, it's going to be pretty much random again, even though in the middle round it was almost all 0. The same happens if you look back towards the plain text. These plain texts are going to be pretty much uniformly distributed. They only collapse into this low Hamming-Wade state in round 5, just by the properties of AES itself, because it's flipping bits, throwing things around. It's actually, you know, almost randomizing things. So if you pick your test vectors in such a way, it'll look random on the plain text side. So your t-test is actually not going to detect the difference between one of those semi-constant vector groups and the random group. It'll only detect it in that middle round where those two groups, the difference between those groups gets amplified. And by the time it hits the end of the crypto algorithm, it'll all be pretty much random again, so you can't detect it anymore. So you're losing that whole problem of the false positives with the plain text that generates spikes. Does everybody get the concept there? I'll show some traces in a second that will also illustrate it. So what you're seeing here at the bottom is actually two simulated traces of AES, where in the circle you see round 5 happening, and you see that in the top one the power consumption actually rapidly drops to 0, and then it comes back up again. So that's actually that one special state that we chose to have a very low Hamming weight, so the power consumption is very low. Whereas at the bottom trace there, where we pick a plain text at random, it's just going to stay in that noisy area. So this is something you can really detect well, the difference between these kind of things using the t-test. Now when you do the statistics over a larger set, you'll see that the top graph there is the value for t. So you see it starts low, and then around the middle section, and you see two gigantic bumps, and then it drops back down again. And that's actually because of the lower two graphs, which are basically the mean of the semi-constant group and the mean of the random group. And the mean of the random group, as you might expect, just is noisy, whereas the semi-constant, you'll see it actually drops down very low. Anybody have an idea why we see you know, two of these dips down, and one is slightly lower than the other one in the semi-constant group. It's actually because of the way that we set up the experiment. So we've chosen the mixed column, which is part of the AES round. We've chosen that output to be zero. There's actually a relation with the steps before that. So if I force that to be almost all zeros, it actually means that the S-pulse output is also going to have a bias. That's why you see not just one dip, but you actually see some effects in the neighboring rounds as well before everything equals out. And this is also the reason why AES has 10 rounds and not 5. Right? Because if you would bias something in the plain text and 5 rounds later would still show up, you have a weak crypto algorithm. So what we're effectively doing here is we're making a 5 round AES by choosing something weird in the middle. So, clever idea, I didn't come up with it. So unless there's any questions about this part? Yeah.
I have to admit that